Good morning. Today is Tuesday, the last day of August. Joining us this morning from, well, headed
city.
Towards Fortuna, the city manager, Merritt Perry. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Brian.
Oh, boy. So we both survived fair weeks.
Yes.
And we got Labor Day staring us in the chops.
Does that mean summer's coming to an end?
I don't think so. I'd love it. Because maybe the fires get contained then.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, wouldn't it, though?
I think we're a ways from that.
That's what everything's kind of pointing towards, isn't it?
Yeah. Although the predictions for the La Nina, bring that on.
Oh. Yeah, no kidding. All right, let's see if we can find a question of the day. I'm not going to ask you why rainbows are round. It's a full-page explanation.
Thank you.
I think it has to do with optics, so it just kind of, well, and carries on to the next page, too. All right, here we go. Our question this morning. Oh, yeah, okay, I've dodged it long enough. Why are prostitutes called hookers?
Let's see.
I think it's kind of like, there's a couple of other analogies, I think. Of why things are named as they are.
I don't know. Maybe when you're walking by in the street, they get their hooks into you and don't let you go. Don't know.
You've heard of Thomas Crapper, right?
Yes.
Okay, now let me ask you again. Why are prostitutes called hookers?
It must have to do with an infectious disease that you may get. Don't know.
Yeah, off toilet seats. No. During the Civil War, a general in charge of the Union Army of the Potomac decided to bolster the morale by permitting prostitutes to have access to his troops. The general's name was Joseph Fighting Joe
Hooker.
Hooker, yes. And the prostitutes who frequented his headquarters became known as Hooker's Girls. Later, when a section of Washington was set aside for brothels, it was called Hooker's Division, and prostitutes then called themselves hookers.
Wow. Thanks for sharing that with me and giving me that one that you
avoided
for...
I just thought I'd let you sweat it out.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't have to guess anymore.
Well, you know, there are others that are even beneath that one.
Okay,
so there we go.
I'm sure I'll see some of those.
Yeah. Well, let's just see what September brings, shall we?
What did I do to upset you, Brian?
Yeah. Oh, my. So we're kind of getting into fall, as you'd indicated. The thing that I find most curious for me projecting into where you guys are is this expanded construction season.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there is a month that we can't be doing something outside the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Is it really, do we appreciate the opportunity that this is really presenting?
Yeah, I think it's what the rest of the state always had. I remember, you know, years ago, I don't even want to date myself, but 10, 20 years ago, maybe even more than that, you know, the winter suspension was a common thing. You just kind of shut her down.
And then October was kind of the magic
month? Yeah, start raining October, November, pretty hard. So November, December, January, February. And, you know, it wasn't uncommon to shut jobs down and put them in suspense for a while. And then it slowly became, well, that's a good time to do concrete. And there's some other things you can do during that time. And now it just doesn't seem like it stops. It seems like the weather holds out and you have discrete storms that come through that you can plan around. So, yeah, I'd say the construction season seems to be going year-round, which, you know, with the amount of work that's out there and the demand for contractors, I suppose it's a really good thing. There's a lot of jobs that people want to get done right now.
Well, if you're going to be shut down for 5 months, you plan accordingly. Projects, scheduling, staffing, that kind of stuff. With this, does that cause extra challenges for the city? Because, you know, I mean, if you're going all the time, obviously you can chew up a lot more money. Now there's a little bit more from the state, you know, because of some of the things that have been funded. But your staff, you know, I would think that there would be a potential of burning them out, too, if they're going all the time.
Actually, I think the opposite, because if you can work on jobs for a longer part of the year, you're not trying to compress as much into a small period of time. So for the city, I mean, I think most of the burden's on a contractor. They're responsible for getting things done on time, right? So we put all the pressure on them. But, you know, we have some on-call contracts like paving and other things. So what it allows us to do is have a more balanced schedule. So, you know, wait till the weather's good. We don't have to put a lot of pressure on folks to get everything done in a few, you know, in a certain part of the year. So it evens it out. I'd say it makes it easier.
Is it better budget-wise? I mean, are you able to get better deals because you can wait instead of knowing, okay, we got to stop by date certain, otherwise it doesn't get done at all?
Is there such thing as a good deal anymore on construction work?
Yeah.
You know, no kidding. I don't think it has as much to do with timing as the job itself and you know, the jurisdiction and how they are to work with. I think contractors learn what to expect from a municipality and how they're going to handle contracts and how they're going to play it. And I think they decide where they want to work. And, you know, they adjust the dollars based on, you know, what they expect for the conditions.
So as you're looking at these, let's call them extended falls.
Extended falls.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, once the leaves are down, it doesn't matter, right?
Oh, right.
I mean, extended fall, yeah. What opportunities present themselves that you're able to do in the last little bit that might be there again this year?
Well, I think for our crews, maintenance, you know, they can get out and they can do more things. You have more time to trim trees. You have more time to do preventative maintenance type tasks with the drainage systems. So I think it just, you know, gives our crews more time to do maintenance. Again, clearly we have a lot of vegetated swales and ditches, so our guys can get out there and our guys and gals can get out there and maintain those. I think it just gives us a little more time if, you know, perhaps we could sneak in an extra paving job here or there. So, yeah, I think it just, again, I think it gives us the luxury of time to get more done.
Well, and if it's labor-based, you're paying the labor anyway, so
yeah, they're already there.
You get a little bit more out of more production.
Yeah. But, you know, I think from contracting and, you know, we have some tank recoating and a roof recoating project, they'll for the digester at the wastewater treatment plant, but they'll have to enclose that to control the conditions anyway. So they'll be able to work through the winter and they'll have to control the environment. So we're also drilling a new well, which is interesting. So I think they'll have that done before the winter time as well.
Oh, well,
no pun intended.
Bull.
You're looking for those.
You are waiting to be able to work that one in. It's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music. ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio. Easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music. Easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Merritt Perry from the city of Fortuna. New well,
yeah.
Sounds so dynamically exciting that I'm sure you have crowds there.
We have some interest. You know, we have some council members that have been interested in the project. And
well, I would think water would get everybody's attention.
Yeah.
And
we have a few wells, and I guess what happens—
But it's not like throwing the coins into
the bucket and you lower down the rope. We got a lot of guys. It takes a lot of folks to kind of reel that bucket up and get that water in the pipes. You'd be surprised.
Yeah. No. And the hamster now is really buff.
Yeah. It's gigantic.
Yeah.
We've gone to capybara.
So did the previous well just kind of, did the ground table shift on it, or did it just see its service life?
You know, what happens is they diminish over time, so you'll see a migration of fines and sediment. So, right, the ideal thing is you have a, you know, well, which is just basically a large pipe in the ground that you shove a pump into, and there's slots or a screen in a certain area.
You make it sound so sexy.
It's pretty,
yeah, slap
it's pretty
a pipe in and pump it.
But over time, you know, you get corrosion and other things that there's ways to fix. But if you start seeing the yield taper off, then, you know, I think what was the assessment of our well that we're replacing was that fines were migrating in, and that it was really just kind of clogging the whole area around the well. So that's why we're drilling a new one. And it's not because the groundwater table is going down. The groundwater table has been pretty stable. It fluctuates, I think, within 6 feet. And then, you know, with each winter, it typically comes back up. So,
So is this – obviously it's associated with the Eel River and the aquifers and the feeding – the sources that feed down into the Eel. When you're looking at something like this, if 25 feet hits water, and I know that's probably not the right depth, but if 25 feet hits, do you take it down to 40 just to kind of as an insurance policy in case there's an earthquake and things shift and it drops a little bit?
Well, it's interesting. What they do is they look at the different types of soils, and then they can tell if they're in a water-bearing strata. So I can't remember the depths on this one, but it's interesting. All our wells are at a depth, and I'm going to totally screw this up, but, you know, just for argument's sake, say they, you know, they're all at about 140 feet. Right now, and there's a gravel strata. What you want is kind of gravel where water can flow in that wet section, because you go through kind of silts and clays that don't have good transmissivity, so you don't see water moving through the ground. And so when you get to that area where you have a little, you know, water's able to move through cleaner gravels, that's generally right. So it's interesting, most of our wells are at a certain level where, you know, one level where there's actually a lot of iron and manganese. And so we actually have we aerate it to try to get those to precipitate out. And, but this time we actually went deeper and we found a cleaner formation underneath. So we're hopeful that this new well, not only will it have high yields, but it'll also, it looks to be of a higher quality too.
So when you're drilling, do you just look at the core samples?
That's what they're looking at. And so, you know, there's what was called, I think, an aquitard in between the two, where you have an impervious layer between the two. And so,
like a clay.
So they went through one gravel, continued down to the next. And so actually when they designed the well, the design is, okay, where do you have your intakes? Where do you have the slots cut? And then also you can seal. You want to keep the layers isolated and separated. So they'll put a bentonite seal in between the different water bearing layers. So you're not changing the dynamic of how the water is in that area. So you could pull from one and not the other, for example.
Do you run a pipe inside a pipe to keep it clean?
I think it's just one big well casing is what they call it, and so it's one pipe, and so they can slot that, and then you slide the pump inside that well casing. And I think typically they're about 6 inches diameter or 8.
So it's not like somebody's going to lose their puppy dog down there?
No. It depends on how old it is. I mean, I suppose.
Well, yeah, okay, fine. But it's not like Lassie's going to trip and fall in the well.
Yeah, I don't know. And there's usually a well head on there, and so it's capped off and clean. You don't want rodents or things getting in there. So, but it's exciting. You never know exactly what your yield is going to be until you get the well in and you do the drawdown tests and you look at the quality. But we're pretty optimistic based on what we were seeing initially with the pilot hole that they drilled to determine what depth we're going to put the well to. So,
now, what kind of pumps do you use on something like that? Or is it a series of them? Or I'm thinking, you know, with the breaking electricity and some of that kind of stuff, are they solar? Do they have generator backups? You know,
so you don't want
the water to stop running.
We have electric pumps, and then we also have we have generators. And then recently we received a state generation incentive program grant. So at the well site location where we have all our wells, there will also be a Tesla battery pack. So if the power goes out, we could run off battery for a while. And
I was thinking maybe you could blast off to the moon.
Well, that would be neat. We could take our whole well
a rocket pack, strap it on, and, you know,
just let our pump go into orbit. That'd be cool, but no.
Okay, fine. How long does a project like that take to complete?
So they went through the design over a period of several months. Put together the construction documents for a well driller to come out and do the pilot hole. So, you know, 4 to 6 months for an engineer to put together the construction plans and specs, and then
EIR and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the actual drilling part doesn't take that long. But they did the pilot hole. I think they came out in 2 or 3 days, and then they'll come back, install the well. It'll probably be about the same.
So it's kind of like Oak Island, Fortuna.
Kind of. We're not allowed to just go take excavators and dig up wetlands in California.
They have
rules against that.
Yeah, okay. It's 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:36. We're back talking shop this morning with Merritt Perry from the city of Fortuna. Merritt, when you're doing some of these exploratory digs, do you anticipate two or three, like for a well? The guys in the petroleum industry spend gazillion dollars trying to find out where to poke and how far down to go. Okay, I suspect you don't have quite that same bankroll to be able to do that. How do you determine where you're going to drop a well and see if you can find water there?
You know, well, all our wells are in one site, and they're off of Eel River Drive, and so we had a pretty good idea. Over time, those wells have produced well. They haven't diminished. Groundwater levels have been stable. So we just found a suitable location that was sufficiently far enough away from the other wells so we could put a new one in, really in the same general area. So we had a pretty good idea. You know, I think then we looked at the depth of the existing well, and then we planned just to go deeper and see what we would find at the adjacent well, at the new well site. And, you know, so you put enough time and budget, it's a pay by the foot kind of thing, right? It's like your put and take trout pond.
It's like sausage. Yeah. You pay by the foot.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and our engineers nailed it this time. They really, they said, well, we should plan for, going, 20 or 40 feet deeper than we originally had. So it really is coming in just really close to what we estimated for the depths and where we're going to put the well casing. I think we were within 5 feet of what we estimated. So had we gone deeper and had to go another 20 feet, there would have been a higher cost for that. So actually came in pretty close to plan. So credit our geologists and engineers.
Are there ever surprises that you find?
You know, we as a city and as an engineer, I've only been on a handful of projects where a new well was installed, and you'd have to talk to the well guys. I mean, the folks who are out drilling wells, they see all that stuff and they're all over the place. And, there's an art and a science to figuring out where you drill it and how you drill it and what you find. And, talk to Dave Fish, Stuart.
A redwood stump at 30 feet under the ground.
You see that
kind of stuff.
You see that in construction projects. I know in the city of Eureka when they were doing the Cooper Gulch dig, they found some interesting redwood, roads and paint,
roads.
People were driving on plank roads, and that's pretty neat when you can see the deeper layers. Not so much in well drilling, I don't think. It's, wood, gravel, mud.
But all that exciting.
I mean, but geologists use
maybe a fossil.
Yeah, I mean, geologists use that as a tool, and that's one of the ways, through trenching or otherwise, you can see where past tsunamis have gone. If you can see a layer of sand that's over the top of, the native soil that's in the place, you can kind of do some deduction based on those soil logs.
But no dinosaur bones.
I'm sure that they've been found that way, but not by me.
Other than limpets.
Yeah.
The stuff in the bluffs.
Out of my area of expertise. Yeah.
Now, you get to play with roads, though, a little bit and have over
bit.
Your career.
Yeah.
Have you found any interesting things there?
Last year, our crews were digging, and this was on a pretty well-established road up. I forgot if it was I think it was on Vansel Street. And they found kind of a door to an opening, to a concrete structure.
Like a bunker kind of thing?
Well, it was underneath the road, so what we think it was maybe an old well house or something that, was an area where the road got filled, so it probably existed, and then they just built the road right over the top of it.
Smushed
and just
it
left
over,
it there.
Yeah. Anything inside?
No.
Really, just a big empty
concrete. Yeah, I don't think no one really could figure out.
You sure
exactly
wasn't from
what
the 40s.
Could have been. I don't know.
Well, I would think some of the work out on Ronerville.
Yeah,
whether or not you could see it, because if you're using a big old digger, maybe you don't see. But there's got to be some cool stories that are in that region.
There probably are. The thing is, a lot of that road's been filled, so we're above all the cool stuff, and so now we're just playing around in the fill. But I always find it intriguing. You know, one of the things I learned when we were trying to study the right-of-way for Ronerville Road, and I might have said this before, but the county has a road register. So, right, it was a list of the roads as they brought them into the county-maintained system, and I think Tom Mattson turned me onto this, and so you can actually go look at this log, and it has a list of each one of the roads. And I think Ronerville Road was number 3 in the road register.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that it's a pretty low number. So that was one of the original roads of the county and, you know, has a lot of history.
I'd put a placard somewhere.
Yeah.
Road number 3.
Yeah. The city right now, we're in escrow to purchase 8 acres adjacent to Newburgh Park, I guess just to the south. The southerly side between
the creek side?
The existing park and Strong Street. Yeah, we're buying that from the Eel River Valley Community Foundation. And they're looking at the title report. There's, you know, references back from the 1850s in the deed, you know, undescribed easements and things like that. So it's kind of interesting when you see those and you can see the conveyance of those. And, you know, you have a notary, you know, a justice of the peace who wrote it up and, you know, in the year of the Lord.
Back when everybody wrote real pretty.
Nice manuscript. And it's funny, you could still see, they'll just draw the seal for the notary. But
It was hand-drawn?
It was just hand-drawn, but it's just a squiggle. It wasn't like some really official thing. It was just, hey, make do. I'm going to write this thing up. It's going to have the basic ingredients. And here's this little bubble cloud circle that is my seal. And it just says seal on it.
That's kind of like the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:42.
Hey, folks. Flying local is buying local. And with 3 airlines serving 5 destinations, Humboldt County has more choices than ever. Fly on American, Avelo, or United Airlines. We have service to Denver, Hollywood Burbank, LAX, Phoenix, and San Francisco airports. Now's the time to book and save on that getaway. Or have friends and family fly to visit the beautiful Redwood Coast. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org. Fly Humboldt, more flights to more destinations.
Good morning, KINS. News and Information Time is 8:46. We're back talking shop this morning with Merritt Perry. How do you avoid not getting sucked up into all the history of Fortuna? There's so much of it, and I would think as a guy at the top of the pyramid that there's almost a responsibility to know and understand a lot of that stuff so that when decisions are made or recommendations are made or reports are made or suggestions are put together, that you have the history that this was Phil or this used to be this and this and that. So you kind of come in with an appreciation of what the community was as you're looking forward into what the community could be.
Yeah, I'd say usually I don't have the luxury. I find the turn of the century to be pretty interesting, but
that's 18s to 19s.
Most of the time, I'll be looking at the 80s and 90s, and you know, why was the business improvement district created, and you know, different, you know, what happened with things that are relevant to policy or franchise agreements for solid waste. So you end up digging up more recent history from the 90s or 80s or sometimes the 70s and like, okay, so what was the purpose of this? You know, what is the mechanism that created it? What was the intention? And because, you know, over time, you know, things get changed. And you know,
a lot of those folks are still around, though.
Yes, they are.
So you can talk to somebody
so you listen.
And say, what do you think?
You listen to people who are involved in forming that policy. You know, guys like Doug Strell. I'm sure you know Doug Strell, who was a longtime planning commissioner, council member, mayor, and actually, I spoke on one of your shows, and I was talking about trying to figure out, you know, where the old racetrack was, and wouldn't it be cool if the Fortuna had the horse racing track that was still around instead of Ferndale, you know? But, So I, when I showed up back at my office, he had a printout and gave me a copy. So I just drove by there the other day, and I'm like, okay, that's where it is.
Can you see?
You can't see it.
Okay.
No.
That's the, like,
but
the
I think
polo,
one
like
of
the
roads
polo
wraps
grounds
around it. So,
okay,
you know,
so you see
it. There's a little bit of legacy. The shape of some of the roads still goes around where it was and the shapes of the parcels. So.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. What would really be neat, and I, you know, this is really getting off track, but to have some kind of an explanation, a plaque, something put in the sidewalk, something that would explain here's why.
Yeah.
And just have a series of here's whys throughout town so that either tourists or just the locals can kind of get a sense of what was and how come and who was strong.
So we have that. We have the Depot Museum, and we have an incredible museum curator, Alex Service. And it's one of those things that I think it's an unappreciated asset, but she's amazing.
Yeah, you almost have to put it in front of people's faces.
Yeah, and so, you know, I know she's had displays about, you know, the Rohner family and why was that? Why is that such a big name around Fortuna? And she recently published a book about the history of the Fortuna Rodeo, and they dug up different facts. And so, you know, I think they did another one, Mills, in around Fortuna. So, you know, she has an incredible understanding.
Not those brown and gold things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those things are so ubiquitous. It's like 5 million of those things are around.
Love it, though. If you found the book that covered your backyard, you'd be pretty darn interested.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right?
You'd be all over it, right? Yeah.
No, but I think it's one of those underappreciated kind of efforts, and the city does have that museum, and there are people that come in and are interested. And I'd recommend anybody who wants to know anything about the history of Fortuna, go in there. You know, we had recently, there was a house that burned down next to the Monday Club, and it was a beautiful old home, and I kind of asked about it and the significance, and she gave me newspaper articles
who owned it and
who built it, and it was like, it was fascinating to be able to take a look at that and how she came up with that so quickly. She just really has a great understanding of the history of Fortuna in that area.
Then you could grieve.
Yeah.
It's not there now.
Yeah, I do miss things when they change, but yep.
So as you look at some of that stuff, does that influence today's decisions? Any of the historical stuff other than legal precedents and whatnot?
You know, I think in different communities they approach it differently. You know, some communities, you know, really take a strong approach to trying to keep things looking the same as they did. And, you know, I'd say, you know, we have to follow state rules. So if you have something that can qualify for the Register of Historic Places, you have to, and you're doing a project, you have to analyze that and protect it from impacts to make sure you don't damage that historic resource. But, you know, some cities will go through and catalog, and they'll look at every house and they'll look at the history, and they're, you know, they may have really stringent design review and building codes where you have to try to make it look exactly like it was or not take down the walls. But, you know, that's not so much the case in Fortuna, but I do think there's a lot of people that do appreciate the history and generally
appreciate,
you know,
it,
people do the right thing with the different types of buildings.
So you got the old mill site.
Yeah.
And I suspect that, you know, there'll probably be a plaque there at some point. Fine. Okay. Are you getting pressures from developers to, you know, with the housing stuff with Humboldt State, maybe develop it more residential than some of the stuff that you talked about last month?
You know, we haven't heard from Humboldt State, but since I came in here last, we have some pretty serious proposals that are coming in front of us for the development of the mill site. So, you know, I can't speak to those specific proposals. But
residential in there, so, part of that space?
Very little potential for residential. Some, you know, really just making sure some of the adjacent neighborhoods that are already designated for multifamily have things like drainage that prevented them. You know, so there's a lot of utilities that go through the mill site, and there's some adjacent properties that are residential that, you know, if drainage was available to them, they'd be able to develop them. There's a few 1-acre parcels that could be multifamily around the outside.
So good stuff. Percolating.
Good stuff percolating.
Back to well talk. All right. Thanks for coming by, bud.
My pleasure.
See you
Thank
every
you.
Tomorrow.